This is the forgetting.
People on this disease just don't think we are getting cured. I don't see that happening. There's no freaking magic pill. But there's a sense of urgency with us that we don't want other families, excuse me, it's just hard to talk about. We don't want other families going through that.
This is a family disease. The caregivers in the family, the financial drain on the family, the emotional drain on the family, and indeed for the respective caregivers, sometimes even some health impacts on other members of the family. This is a family disease. I think people need to talk about it. People need to talk about people living with the disease and not just dying of the disease, and in fact support people who are living with the disease.
From CDM Studios in Manhattan and from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., this is The Forgetting, a podcast about dementia. I'm David Shank, author of the book The Forgetting and senior advisor to the international research consortium called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, which helps make this podcast possible. And with me is, as always, I couldn't do it without him, is my friend and co-host Greg O'Brien, author of On Pluto, Inside the Mind of Alzheimer's. His book has that subtitle because Greg has early onset Alzheimer's disease, and he is committed to reporting his experience for as long as he possibly can. That's why this podcast exists. Hey, Greg.
Hey, David. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's so nice to be in a room with you again.
I know.
It always makes my day when we're together.
You know, I'm sitting here in front of this Purell Advanced Kills Most Germs hand cream, and I was wondering if you had used it before you shook my hand.
No, I probably gave you all kinds of New York bacteria when we shook hands.
That's how I wouldn't expect anything less.
And we have a really special guest today. This is something we've been looking forward to for months and months and months, and Greg and I have been talking about when we could make it happen. I want to welcome to our program a man named George Vredenburg, who doesn't really need an introduction, but he is the co-founder and head of just a really important nonprofit institution based in Washington, D.C., called Us Against Alzheimer's. And is that how you pronounce it, George, or do you say U.S. Against Alzheimer's?
No, it's us, and it refers to the fact that defeating this damn disease is going to be a team sport requiring all of us.
Right, right. Well, George, it's so nice. It's such an honor to have you. Thank you for joining us. I know that you would do anything for Greg, but I'm thanking you anyway for doing this.
Well, David, thank you for your book, and thank you for your efforts over the years as well. But Greg O'Brien is one special person, and he's a brother, and I'd do anything for him.
Yeah, well, I'd take a bullet for you, George. So,
well, let's not try that back and forth.
If it's me or George that are like, you know, falling off the cliff, and you have to grab one, which line are you going to hold on to first, Greg? We need some priorities here.
Okay, George is taller, so he would need more of an anchor. So my gut would probably be that way.
Right.
You could float a little bit because you're smaller.
I'm going to take that as a compliment that you think that I could get myself out of that, you know, that pickle.
Yeah, because you're a smart guy.
So you believe in me more, really. That's what I'm hearing.
Really? Is this a test? Is that what we're doing?
It's all a test.
Okay.
Does that make me a dumb guy?
Yeah. George pretty damn smart, so we may be outwitted here.
George is pretty capable. George, give us a history of Us Against Alzheimer's, starting with the reason, the personal reason behind it, and give us a little bit about you know, where it started, how it started, and what it's evolved to.
Well, it started in 2010. My wife's mother and grandmother had been killed by this disease. My wife's mother had been diagnosed in 85 and then died in 92. It is 25 years after my wife's mother's diagnosis, and we looked around and said to ourselves, nothing's really happening in this movement. We need some disruption. We need some passion. We need an urgency. So let's get into it. Let's jump into it. Both feet, both arms, the whole body. And so we dedicated the rest of our lives and really as much resources as we could afford to stopping the disease. It's now has seven individual networks of individuals and organizations aligned around veterans, women, African Americans, Latinos, researchers, the faith community, and others. And so that is the core organization that basically mobilizes people around the country to basically demand change, demand speed, demand efficiency, demand collaboration. It had a spinoff shortly after we were able to get the government to declare a goal of finding a means of prevention and treatment of the disease by 2025. We decided to organize a business coalition that would partner with government on what obviously is a shared problem needing shared solutions. So we started the Global CEO Initiative in 2013, and it has grown since then to now 20 companies with market cap over $1 trillion. One of the priorities set by government and by business was faster, less expensive, more efficient clinical trials in Alzheimer's. So we dropped down a special purpose entity, a separate 501c3 called the Global Alzheimer's Platform Foundation, and it is now a $50 million project going to $75 million in financing over 5 years to re-engineer Alzheimer's clinical trials. Finally, we created, actually co-created, an mobilization organization called Leaders Engaged in Alzheimer's Disease, LEAD, whose purpose is basically to create a single voice in the Alzheimer's community. And it's now 90 Alzheimer's-serving organizations that are members of LEAD. So we've grown from a single nonprofit to now a multiple set of organizations with particular purposes, and we operate globally. So we operate around the world. I sit on the World Dementia Council, appointed there by David Cameron, which is an effort to try and bring all of these efforts together around the world.
Would, with all of the nuance and complexity and different ways of outreach that you just described, which I appreciate very much, would it be too crude to say that at least this started mainly, or at least that your first priority was to get the U.S. federal government to increase its research budget for Alzheimer's in a significant way since it had been stuck in the same place for so long?
That was certainly our very, very initial tactic, and that is obviously a continuing tactic because we're still not at the levels of investment that we need. We've moved from a little over $400 million a year to $1.4 billion this fiscal year, and the appropriation subcommittees in both the House and the Senate have proposed that it be moved to $1.8 billion next year, fiscal 18. Of course, fiscal 18 started on October 1 down here in Washington. We're always a little off down here. And we don't have a budget yet for this year. We're on a continuing resolution through the end of the year. But hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have a budget approved and to be able to move annual NIH investment levels in Alzheimer's disease to $1.8 billion a year.
Wow, that's amazing. And I hope that you can take some, with obviously the disease not cured yet and you still having so much work to do, you can still take an enormous amount of satisfaction from being, if not the leader, probably the leader, but if not the leader, certainly a major force in raising that big central number of $400 million in research annually to now $1.4 billion. That's just an extraordinary achievement.
Well, thank you for saying that. The work is hardly done. I mean, we set a target 6 years ago of getting to $2 billion a year because it was an enormous leap. It would have been a five times multiple of what it was when we started. But with that said, annual investment in cancer is now between $6 and $7 billion a year. Annual investment in HIV/AIDS, which is a manageable disease, is $3 billion a year. So we still, as underfunded compared to other disease conditions, particularly if you look at the relative costs of cancer and of Alzheimer's to society, Cancer is something around $65 to $70 billion a year, and we are about $260 billion a year in cost to society. And of course, HIV/AIDS really has become a relatively modest cost to society because we've been so successful. So where we've invested money in these disease conditions, we've made enormous progress. Cancer is making progress, certainly not solved by any stretch of the imagination, but making progress. HIV/AIDS, we've made enormous progress. It's a manageable disease, as I said. But Alzheimer's, still, we don't have any means of curing it, of actually modifying the course of the disease, or preventing it. So we're still in a sense, from a patient's perspective and therapeutic products, in the Stone Age.
George, speaking of numbers, I should also say that I'm on the board of Us Against Alzheimer's, proud and honored to be on that board. Talk about the projections in the future for people to have Alzheimer's, and also, if you can, factor in some way the fact that there are a lot of people out there who haven't been diagnosed or diagnoses that aren't reported properly.
Well, the numbers, because we are an aging society, because we are an aging society around the globe, the numbers are pretty staggering. Right now, it's 5.5 million in the United States that are estimated to have dementia. That does not account for probably double the number, that number, who have preclinical, that is, pathology of the disease, but they don't yet have symptoms. And globally, the disease is now closing in on 50 million victims. And if you look at the number of AIDS victims around the world, just as a comparison, we're about 1.5 times the number of AIDS victims. Number of people who die every year from this disease globally is well into the millions, probably 4 to 5 million people who die every year of this disease. And the cost is staggering. It's $260 billion here, but it's well over $1 trillion globally. And these numbers are going up. We have 75 million baby boomers in this society turning now 70 at the rate of 10,000 a day. But China has 450 million baby boomers. So they're turning to Alzheimer's at a rate that's 6 times that. So 60,000 people a day are now turning 70 in China. So the numbers are simply staggering. The cost to society is staggering. But beyond the financial cost, this is a family disease. So it's not just the person with the disease, as Greg well knows and can describe, and I'm sure has described to your audience, but it is a family disease. The caregivers in the family, the financial drain on the family, the emotional drain on the family, and indeed for the respective caregivers, sometimes even some health impacts on other members of the family. This is a family disease.
You just provided the perfect segue to take a sharp left turn, and we will continue in a few minutes and talk more about all the politics and the demographics and the challenges on the level that you face them on our behalf. But let's bring this back to the personal. First, let's talk about the person who's not in the room with us now, your wife, who we recently lost, Trish, who was a part of the inspiration and the founding of this organization. Can you tell us about Trish? We're both obviously so sorry for your loss, and tell us about Trish.
Well, Trish was the love of my life. She was my partner in life. We were married 49 years. She died suddenly of a heart attack. She was a sitcom writer. She wrote for Designing Women, Kate and Ally, Family Ties. She wrote a play about her family's experience with the disease, which was comedic as well as what you would expect with respect to a family affected by Alzheimer's. And so, her loss was pretty devastating. I continue this. Her spirit is still certainly in me, certainly in the organization, and we are doing a number of things to keep her spirit in the movement. We've started a Be Trish campaign based upon remarks that her brother made at the memorial service when he said, how can you sustain the legacy of my sister? He said she was optimistic, She was a gladiator in the fight against Alzheimer's, so she not, was optimistic, but she felt she everyone had an obligation to try and make the world a better place, and everyone ought to be fighting against this disease and fighting for a cure. But so if you want to honor my sister, be Trish. Be optimistic. Believe you can change. Don't take no or you can't do it for an answer. And so she continues. That spirit continues, obviously, in me, but and I'm carrying on that legacy, but it also stays inside our organization and our staff and really in the movement.
Can you say a little bit more about, I think you said it was her father who had the disease, which was your main personal connection to it, at least originally, and what that, was that something, how did you experience that? Did you help care for him? Was it, you know, can you talk about what he went through and how that impacted Trish's family and your family?
It was actually Trish's mother. Her name is Bea Lerner. She was a very prominent political figure in the Democratic Party in New Jersey, actually credited by JFK as winning the state for him based upon a quirk of circumstance that had her creating a 100,000-person event on the weekend before the 60 election, and Kennedy won the state by 51,000 votes. And in that era, Jersey and Illinois were the two swing states. So she was credited with really winning the presidency for Kennedy, at least winning New Jersey and having a decisive role in the election. She was a dynamo. She was a civic leader. She was a political leader. She was something special and with enormous energy and enormous drive. And she began to experience hallucinations in 85. She called us one night about 3 a.m. and said there was a man in the house that was threatening her with a knife. We went to the house, couldn't find anyone in the house other than her husband. And looked everywhere, and she insisted that there were men in the house. And she pulled my wife aside and said, "Who is that man?" It was her husband. And so she was hallucinating the fact that her husband was trying to kill her, which he wasn't. And so it degraded from there. She was stopped for driving too slowly in the Holland Tunnel, 5 miles an hour. There were some things that in retrospect were funny. But one of the things that happened was that she fell at home, broke her hip. Her husband was unable to continue to care for her. So she did go into a facility. And Trisha's father, Bea Lerner's husband, was beginning himself to deteriorate. So my wife sent him off to Florida for some R&R. And he meets and falls in love with another woman while he's in Florida. And there the comedy ensues as the bimbo, as we called her affectionately in the family, was taken to the nursing home for joint visits, became part of the family. My kids, her grandchildren, my daughter said, I can understand this. Grandpa is himself deteriorating. He needs a life as well. My son said, "Whatever happened to till death do us part." So, you know, you had the family reaction to that. You had the husband's reaction to it. They were not wealthy people, so basically, the cost of caring for her both at home and then subsequently in a facility were enormous and basically threatened their solvency. So, you know, you get angry at this disease, particularly when you see it at the end, when the person becomes absolutely incapable of communicating. In fact, she was incapable of really moving out of a wheelchair or bed. And that went on for 2 or 3 years in her case. And it's gone on for many more years for others in that condition. So you get angry at this disease. You want to take revenge. You don't want to sort of say, "Oh, that's just aging." It isn't just aging. You don't want to say, "Okay, that happens to people." No, it doesn't happen to people. You can go kill this goddamn disease. And as Greg knows, I've been using the phrase, put a stake through the heart of the devil here. And Greg is even more vociferous about the language he uses about this disease. We've got to fight it.
I drop a few F-bombs, but yep. You know, I think I'm on a pitch count here with David. So,
so that was my family story. It was bad. Trish was actually commuting to L.A. at that time from New Jersey, writing for Designing Women, and so I was in Jersey and spent a fair amount of time with my father and mother-in-law. Trish saw them periodically and was just stunned by the changes, even, you know, in 3 or 4 week intervals when she commuted back to Jersey.
I don't want to lead the witness here, George, but remember you and I were out in L.A. recently speaking, and we both made the case to numerous people that this isn't your grandfather's disease, this is a family disease. And when you talk about the rage against Alzheimer's in terms of the anger of it, then you also have to deal with the rage of inside individuals like me who are raging. And it creates a very difficult family dynamic that you can't run away from. So when you say X number of people have this disease, I think when someone has it, the family has it. I think when you look at its impact, you got to add all the other people impacted by that, which can be different from some other diseases. As I said before, I don't want a single cent spent less on any of the other disease. I just want parity with Alzheimer's because, frankly, the train has left for me. And people in my state feel the same way. There's going to be no magic pill. But I'm worried about my grandchildren and my children and your grandchildren and your children and David's and everyone else who's listening. So maybe talk a little more, which you've talked about the family and how that has motivated you.
Well, there's no question because my wife's mother and grandmother died of this disease, that there was a certain vector, a certain tangent, a certain directionality to it that was coming down the maternal line. And so my concern for my wife, while she said she had no concern, there was no question that she did. My concern for my wife, my daughter, I have two granddaughters. Of course, I'm in total denial that I'll ever get the disease, but in fact, there is certainly a likelihood that I will as well. But so this is personal, and this is something that you rage against. My co-founder and Greg and my mutual friend Merrill Comer says we'd have to turn the pain into action to mobilize around it. One of the things that everyone can do is talk about it. Too often we tend to protect our loved one from social embarrassment because they ask repetitive questions. And of course, when you get diagnosed with this disease, you're still alive. You're not dead. And so you may communicate differently. You may be somewhat awkward in social occasions. That's not the problem of the person with the disease. That's the problem of the people who are feeling uncomfortable. They should recognize that the person has a disease, accommodate to it, and not try and shun it. So I think people need to talk about it. People need to talk about people living with the disease and not just dying of the disease, and in fact support people who are living with the disease. Greg is one of the most courageous people I know because he is not hiding. He's not hiding out. He is speaking out, and he's been active. And if everyone with this disease or every family that experiencing this in their family spoke out the way Greg did, this disease would not be at $1.4 or $1.8 billion a year. It would be cancer size levels. And we'd be investing like mad. We'd be leading the world in this. President Obama or now President Trump, whose father died of the disease, by the way, should be out there basically saying the United States can lead this fight, should be leading this fight with both resource and leadership, because we're finding in Congress that one of the elements that has changed is that members of Congress are beginning to talk publicly about the disease in their own family and finding that so many of their colleagues have the disease in their family. So it's no longer just, is it Republican, is it Democrat, how does it affect the budget? It's become personal, it's become nonpartisan, it's become something the Democrats and Republicans will tackle together. And so talking out about the disease, talking about what's happening in your family with this disease has been an enormous driver of change. Yeah, and Greg, Greg is the exemplar of what one should do if one has the disease. President Reagan, when he got diagnosed with the disease, wrote a letter to the American people. But too often, people sort of hide out. They shouldn't.
George, let's get back into the politics, if you don't mind. Let's dig a little deeper, because there's probably no one alive who knows more about the American politics of Alzheimer's disease than you. And as I said earlier, you've been integral in getting that funding raised way up, and it's still not enough. But boy, is it a far cry from what it was. Can you talk about who's leading the movement in Congress, and maybe we can even start talking about some particular people in Congress, and where they are in this issue, and who we're working on, and who we need to work on, and stuff like that.
Well, for years, Ed Markey has been he started as the singular voice on this issue back in 1999 when he created the Alzheimer's House Caucus with Chris Smith, a Republican from Jersey. And so he has been a singular, outspoken, now member of the Senate who's done this. And Susan Collins of Maine, a Republican, who's both sides of whose family have been affected by this disease, is another. She calls the disease the family disease because virtually everyone in the generation above her had been affected by the disease. But the list is broadening now. People that you would not have thought of as being champions are now becoming the champions. As far as Republicans, Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri has become a champion, and he sits as chair of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee dealing with HHS. Tom Cole, a conservative Republican from Oklahoma, sits as the House Appropriations chair of the subcommittee dealing with HHS. They have been championing much more significant increases, but so are their Democratic counterparts. And so we're seeing a significant wave. Debbie Stabenow of Michigan has been a real champion. Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia has been a champion. But you could go into virtually every senator's office now and say, I'm here on behalf of Alzheimer's, and they say, I'll support you before you get a second sentence out of your mouth. And so the real political challenges are to get a government to change its priorities. If you spend $6 billion on a disease like we do with cancer, the number of researchers, the number of academics and academic institutions that are committed to the cancer movement is enormous. And so there's an enormous sense of momentum and commitment to the cancer movement that's entirely appropriate. But then you say, well, what about Alzheimer's? And they say, well, who do we take the money from? You just can't spend additional money in the government without thinking for what they call pay-fors. How do you spend more money on one thing without taking it from somewhere else? And so Republicans and Democrats do have different priorities about where they might take the money from. Republicans might favor taking it from other social programs, which they don't believe are productive or as important. Democrats would tend to take it from the defense expenditures, which is itself another set of politics. So the real battle here is trying to get priorities of government changed when, in fact, you're confronting a crisis. But, of course, in this world, ISIS is a crisis. Ebola is a crisis. The opioid crisis is a crisis. So you will see that different members of Congress will have different perspectives on what the priorities of government ought to be. So our fight is not now for people who will raise their voice for Alzheimer's and want to support it. Our battle is with how in the heck do you raise money for Alzheimer's and where do you get it from? So that is the difference between R's and D's. It's not on the disease anymore. It's now on where do you take the money from to invest increasing amounts of money in NIH and in Alzheimer's.
And where do you take the money from if a Republican is talking to you saying, you know, I don't know where to get the money. I agree with you that this is, you know, as important as anything can be, but I don't know where to get the extra, you know, the $400 million a year that you want.
Well, the Republicans, interestingly, maybe counterintuitively, the Republicans in the last, since they've controlled both houses of Congress in the last two, now three fiscal years, have been more aggressive on Alzheimer's investments. They have been willing to move money from, as I say, social support programs, safety net programs that they don't believe are working or are very productive. Democrats protect social support programs and safety net programs like their eldest child. It is, and taking money from the defense budget is not a practical matter because it's such a huge piece of the budget and the world is not a safe place. So I will tell you that this is, as I say, it's not an R and a D in terms of supporting Alzheimer's. It's an R and D in terms of where you take the money. And the Republicans have been willing to take it. It's a relatively modest amount of money in a $3 trillion budget to find another $400 or $500 million. But it does have to come from somewhere. And the Republicans have been taking it in the last few years from some social safety net programs that they don't believe are very productive.
And I take it, but and this is just a dumb question to ask, but I want to ask it anyway, because I imagine you're in the room and you're having this conversation with Republicans and Democrats. Do you just avoid answering that question? Because you don't want to be put in the position of being a politician in the sense of you're taking money from somewhere else, or do you give them suggestions? How do you just personally deal with this end of the conversation if it comes up like that?
Well, your intuition was exactly right. We advocate for additional research money on Alzheimer's. We do it for both economic reasons, because the cost of the nation is now $260 billion, and we're investing, you know, $1.4 billion to try to manage that cost problem. That's just not practical. You need to invest more to save more, demonstrating, as we have with HIV or with cancer, and indeed with cardiovascular disease, that investments have actually reduced the incidences of those disease or the ability to manage them. So, in fact, on an economic, pure economic basis, additional investment makes sense. And we leave to the politicians the choice of where they find the money to pay for those additional investments. So you're absolutely right. We don't get in the business of saying, take it from here, take it from there. We get in the business of saying, this is a compelling need, whether viewed as an economic matter, as a fiscal matter, as a social matter, or as just a human suffering matter.
So Greg is about to ask a very important and interesting question. It's going to take a little bit of a turn, but I just wanted to second your notion that just from my experience with on the science side of this, dealing with some of the great researchers of the world in Alzheimer's, that it's just so clear that the bottleneck in stopping this disease, and this is somewhat rare compared to other health concerns, the true bottleneck is not ideas, it is money. It's easy to say as a cliche, well, you can't just throw money at a problem and cure it. And obviously money needs to be well spent and smartly spent and all that. But we have a lot of ideas about things that need to be investigated and trials that need to be run. And we just don't have the money to do it. And the way to speed up, if there's one way to speed up the process of getting to a cure or a preventative or whatever you want to, however you want to think about it, it is just increasing this pile of research money. Greg?
On the subject of money, George, and outside the public sector, let's just talk about the private sector. And maybe George and I were just out recently in Los Angeles for the International X Prize Award, and maybe explain a little about that and your encouragement over that, George, that Alzheimer's won that prize.
Well, it was a pretty exciting weekend. This is an interesting, the X Prize organization is an interesting special organization that manages global crowdsourced competition-based prizes to stimulate the best ideas from around the world and from a wide variety of fields. And so we put forward, Greg and I and two other members of our team, put forward an Alzheimer's X Prize as to try and get an X Prize launched next year. We were competing against China and Chile, and Singapore and Deloitte, 10 individuals had invested in the Alzheimer's development effort. We succeeded heads and shoulders above these other problems that would be financed by much larger organizations. And if we went through a whole series of presentations over the course of 2 days, and every time we asked how many of you in this room have been affected by the disease, more than 50% of the hands went up. So you could just sense that, in fact, so many people are being touched by this disease, and there's such a hunger for getting at a cure that is very powerful. So we are going to launch this XPRIZE next year, and we are going to put the science on a course of curing it. With respect to investment, the United States government invests, as I say, $1.4 billion this year. But industry will probably be investing $5 to $6 billion a year. And the governments in other parts of the world are investing money as well. My own guess is, although it's not very transparent, that China may be investing as much money in this the cure of this disease as the United States is. But there's no cooperation among governments. There's no real sharing because all taxpayer money really has to stay inside the country of the taxpayers. So we really can't get government to sort of pool a pot of money or to actually get a joint program. It's basically just non-cooperative. But the problem in terms of the people is global. The companies that are trying to solve it is global. The clinical trial systems that need to test medicines in human beings is global. And so trying to get not just more resource from the U.S. government, but trying to create the conditions where you're going to get more companies investing more monies in development of medicine, development testing of medicines, is an objective as well in terms of trying to raise additional finance. So we spend a good deal of money not just trying to mobilize politically to get more money out of the U.S. government. We also have a business coalition that's basically tried to shorten clinical trials and increase the efficiency of those trials. So, in fact, companies who have chosen to invest lots of money here can invest in more products and run them through the testing system much faster. We're working with global regulators to make sure they're ready to receive a safe and effective drug and approve it. We're working with government payers around the world, from Medicare to all of the differential government payment systems in other parts of the world, to be ready to pay for the medicines that may come out of the system, because they're rebelling about investing in a prevention medicine and paying for years for millions of people taking a medicine that might prevent symptoms without seeing actual cost reductions. So there's huge budgetary impacts of getting governments to pay or support the payment for these drugs. And if we can't get that done, you're only going to find middle and upper middle class people who can afford these drugs. So we need to have governments involved. And then finally, you need a doctor population that is medically equipped with the right tools, with the right education, and the right incentives to actually talk to people about their brain health. Because right now, believe it or not, we are diagnosing this disease late, and we're diagnosing it wrong. And in fact, the CDC has reported that only one-third of the time do doctors actually deliver the diagnosis they have in their head to the patient, because they don't know how to have a conversation about what they think is a terminal disease. So we have a lot of elements in the system that need change beyond just getting more research money. There's a whole series of roadblocks and barriers to getting more medicines to more people faster through a system of regulation and a system of payment.
George, I can't tell you how just fantastic it's been to get into the nitty-gritty of all this and to hear you talk about it at some length. We are we need to wrap up now. What we usually do with this podcast is I usually talk to Greg for a few minutes about what he's going through in his life before we bring in a guest. We didn't have the time to do that this time. So what I would love to do is invite you to stick around for just 5 more minutes while I talk to Greg about what's going on in his life. And since you're such a close friend to Greg and you know him and what he's going through so well on a personal level, feel free to jump in and be the other journalist. It'll be 3 journalists talking to each other But I want to take a real hard turn now and just get in, because what we're doing with this podcast is we try to talk to each other at least, Greg and I, at least once a month, and we're just kind of marking the quote unquote progress of this disease and what he's experiencing personally. So, having said that, Greg,
yes,
how are you feeling?
Well, there's a side of me who wants to say great, but if you ask my family, they'd say not so well. You know, I mean, we were talking about this out in Los Angeles. You know, if I wore it on my sleeve like that and people pitied me, then they wouldn't think about fighting a cure and realizing that it affects them. So having said that, my life sucks. I'm facing bankruptcy. The rage is increasing more and more. Blackouts are continuing. That's why the doctors don't let me drive anymore. Hallucinations are continuing. There are days when I just want to give up. It kicks the shit out of me. And then I go off to a place like Los Angeles to that XPRIZE, and I see that people really do care. And that bucks me up. My urgency as I see this right now, as I said this before, and I'll tell you that, you know, because everyone, you know, loves to you know, think about, well, we're going to cure this and cure that. You know, people on this disease just don't think we are getting cured. I don't see that happening. There's no freaking magic pill. But there's a sense of urgency with us that we don't want other families, it's just hard to talk about. We don't want other families going through that. And as George knows, when we were there, my son Connor was in the audience, and I pointed to him and I told people in the audience, please don't let that happen to you, because this isn't about me, this is about you, and this is about your families. And George saw that, and I think it had an impact on people, and I wasn't expecting it. It just overcame me when I saw him standing back there. George, any thought on it?
I just make an observation or two, because I've known Greg now for a few years. He has a harder and harder time being in a room where more than one person is talking. So cocktail parties, dinner things, it just overwhelms his senses, and he just has to step out, step aside, and sort of get out of the melee. I was sitting at one point with Greg at an outside dinner party, and Greg got up. And Connor wasn't there, and Connor noticed he was missing, and immediately came over and said, "Where's Dad?" He is constantly sort of hyper vigilant about making sure that Greg does not walk away or get lost or wander. So that sense of hyper vigilance on the part of a caregiver was so evident. Greg gets tired sooner and faster than he used to. The problem with Greg is that he sounds so good. He looks so good. And so you just don't understand what's going on inside his head and the complications that he's experiencing. And so in a sense, it's hard to understand. The people in the room when Greg was talking, he grabs people, he gets them because he writes so well, he speaks so well. Ken Dykewald, our partner, sort of moderating some of this discussions, would ask him questions, and he wouldn't remember our names. But you never noticed that by looking at him or by hearing him speak. In his case, he was reading text as opposed to being extemporaneous. But still, you just say, this guy doesn't have Alzheimer's. Well, yes, he does.
Yeah, it does. He does put off some misdirection with how articulate he is. But I had to say, I have to say, I noticed in myself that before we started today, Greg needed to go to the bathroom, and I instinctively took him to the bathroom, which is not something I would have done 6 months ago, because I just have this sense, you know.
Well, I took a wrong turn when I came out.
Right,
I said. I got a call, and I started dropping F-bombs in the hallway, and this is just the backstory that people don't see. And then I said, okay, well, I just called David, and I realized I left my phone in here, and I go, oh, shit.
I wondered if you'd come back. I knew you'd be safe enough, but I did have to rush back because we were out of pressed for time. I needed to kind of set up the mic here, but I thought, I wondered, well, so if Greg doesn't come right back, I'm going to have to go out. You know, so we're aware of that. Even though it's hard to hear with how articulate
but
you are.
Just getting, if we have a quick point back on what George is saying, I'm surrounded, George, by a lot of individuals who really get upset when about the stereotype. Well, if you got Alzheimer's, you can't speak. Now, I was blessed by God early on to be able to speak and write. So when the light is on my brain, I ought to, at this stage, might be able to do some of that. And a good example, that getting back to the event at Fairfield, this guy, Tommy Kerwin, stood up. He looks good. He spoke well, but then he started talking about the symptoms, and you could see the tears streaming down people's faces that have known this guy. And we just got to stop doing the damn drive-by, and look into people's souls. I always told people, hey, do I look like I got cancer? As you guys know, I got cancer, I'm not treating it. Do I look like I have depression? I had clinical depression since I was a boy. Do I look like I have spinal stenosis and scoliosis or no feeling in my feet and my hands? So why do we have to wear that on our sleeve before we get people's attention? And I think the answer is because they're scared. I don't think they don't care.
I don't think we know socially how to talk about our health until we have a problem, we start talking about it, and we find that the person you're talking with will start reporting their health conditions. You need an icebreaker. You need to start talking about it, and then you're going to find that people do have lots of health issues, and I think people are stunned by brain health issues, bipolarity, depression, certainly Alzheimer's. And because as you can't see it, and for a very long time, you can't discern it in people with the disease.
Yeah. Well, we're just getting going on what could be another really interesting hour, but we are just flat out of time. So that's it for our show today. Greg and I would like to thank our extraordinary guest, George Radenberg, for joining us.
Love you, brother.
The Forgetting is a production of WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH in Boston. Our producer is the great Sean Corcoran. Thank you, Sean. Our theme music was composed and produced by Dr. Rudy Tanzi, who is also the chair of the Research Consortium at Cure Alzheimer's Fund. Thank you, Rudy, as always. And Greg, you still owe me that $100.
Okay, I'm going to pay you Monopoly money. George gave me a bunch of it.
Sounds good.